From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 376 for November the 20th, 2011. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and our long-distance number, 1-800-580-2372. All our lines are available, and if you wish to call in early, I encourage you to do so. We can get you on the air and answer your questions. I wanted to cover several stories, one of which is sort of in the headlines more so than others, and this has to do with the Food and Drug Administration in the United States revoking the approval for the treatment of certain forms of breast cancer with the drug Avastin. It announced that it's no longer approved for treatment of breast cancer, specifically metastatic HER2 negative, that is, women who do not have the receptors for HER2 type breast cancer. It's still recommended to be used in the treatment of other cancers such as colon cancer and lung cancer, but nevertheless, they've removed it from the indications for breast cancer. And the reason for this is that the original approval process, and this is where one of those conundrums you have with drug approvals, is that the original approval was fast-tracked in the United States in 2008 because of a study that showed that patients taking Avastin lived an average of 5.5 and a half months more of progression-free survival, that is, where the cancer did not progress, than those treated with a particular common chemotherapy agent. So in other words, when they combined these two medications together, the other drug was called paclitaxel, there was 11.3 months of progression-free survival versus 5.8 months. But the proviso for approving or fast-tracking this was that the company that produced this, Genentech, was required to conduct more clinical trials to prove that the treatment was indeed efficacious and safe. And the additional trials have now been done. It's now 3 years later. And they have demonstrated that they failed to confirm the original 5.5 months. And in fact, what's happened is that in follow-up studies, the 5.5 months of progression-free survival with Avastin seen in earlier trials disappeared to 0.8 months, so less than a month of difference, and no new benefits were observed. But in a 69-page decision from the Food and Drug Administration, they noted that there were notable side effects: severe high blood pressure, hemorrhages, heart attacks, heart failure, and perforations in the nose, stomach, and intestines. So in terms of a risk versus benefit for that particular group of women being treated for HER2 negative breast cancer, they found that there was very little indication to continue to use this medication for those purposes. So this is obviously causing some consternation among those who believe that the medication is helpful. But we have to keep in mind that when you do clinical trials, you have to have a sufficient number of people in order to evaluate over the long term whether something is useful or not. And so you can have a small study, do say it's study A, that shows that you have a benefit, but then you can have study B that comes up and shows no benefit, and then study C and D and E, and this is what tends to happen over time when you're trying to evaluate whether something is effective or not. And in this case, this showed that further studies did not demonstrate a benefit. So although the reason for fast-tracking a medication, obviously, if you have women who are suffering with breast cancer and you have a medication that seems to cause or seems to be effective in improving their quality of life, you want to try and see if you can help these people. But in this case, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, because you can say, oh, well, you know, the clinical trials seem to show benefit and people will be clamoring to use it, naturally so, especially when people are desperate for treatments. If they've come to a point in their treatment management cycle that leaves them very little options, they're going to want to say, hey, you know, I want to be able to have this drug made available. But on the other hand, you then have follow-up studies that show it's not beneficial, and you have the side effects. So you're really stuck, because if you, for example, if you didn't do the follow-up studies and then you saw a lot of these patients ended up with serious side effects, people would say, why didn't you do further studies to evaluate this and make sure that you weren't doing any harm? So they've done their proper due diligence in terms of evaluating the medication. And remember, it was approved because they were going to continue more tests. That was part of the process. It wasn't the matter of approving it and then saying, hey, you know, go off and do your study, other studies, but it really has no relevance to our decision. So there was a specific decision made on that count. On much better news, doctors in London, this is a first-time event. Doctors in London, King's College Hospital in South London, used a technique that is a world first. This was a little boy, 8 years old, who had, his name is Syed, who had liver failure. And there was no liver transplant available. And without any help, he would have died. So what they did is they created a temporary liver. They used cells, liver cells, and coated them with a specific type of chemical found in algae, which prevented them from being attacked. So this was a temporary transplant, and these liver cells took over the function of his failing liver. And over the next 2 weeks, because what you have to keep in mind is that the liver is quite a robust organ. If you give it a chance, for many instances, it can regenerate. It's the only organ that can actually regenerate itself. And if you give it an opportunity to do that, it obviously will get better. But the problem is that you can't live without a liver, because it's responsible for processing everything in your body with regards to breaking down various toxic substances, to converting other things that your body needs. It's essentially your biochemical factory of your body. And so if you have someone who's in liver failure, you don't have that time to let the liver regenerate, because you die from the liver just not doing what it's supposed to do. So in this case, they injected these cells into his abdomen. They took over the process of what his liver was supposed to do, but at the same time were protected by this coating over them from being attacked and destroyed by his own body. And after 2 weeks, his liver began to recover. And now he is a completely healthy boy. His liver has recovered, and those cells are no longer needed. His body likely has gotten rid of them over time. And this was a first-time treatment, and the child is now healthy and happy and doing very well. Now, so what they're going to be doing next, because again, this is only a study of one person, is that whether the technique can be used to benefit other patients with acute liver failure. And the team at King's College is urging caution. They're saying a large clinical trial is needed to test the effectiveness of the technique. But the key benefit over a liver transplant is that this particular boy will not need to take any anti-rejection drugs known as immunosuppressants. So this is a new technique, certainly a groundbreaking technique, likely to be followed up in the near future. And I thought that was a really nice story, seeing there's a picture of the little boy. It's from BBC News. You can go to their site, BBC News Health section, and read up on it. And I thought that was really a neat thing to see. Very nice to see a young child survive after that. All our lines are available. And as I've said before, I don't want to talk to myself for the next hour. So I'm looking forward to your calls. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Hey! Well, I can tell Sebastian is back with the heavy metal music. all our lines are free, ladies and gentlemen. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Any comments or questions you might have, things that you've heard in the news, the hepatitis C report this week, which really confused causality and association and risk. Talked about that with Mark Sutcliffe earlier this week. And in Madeley in the Morning, we talked about how this particular revelation of testing for hepatitis C produced four people out of about 3,400 found to have hepatitis C. And my comment to Mark was, well, given that hepatitis B is even more common, why didn't we see hepatitis B infections, at least a number of them, when none were found? So we have to be very careful when considering whether something really was the result of this particular procedure or whether this was something that these people had developed either before or after the procedure for other reasons altogether. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. Another item from BBC News, this is from the 16th of November, Sea Salt Health Claims Flawed. This was a organization that called the Research for Which and Consensus Action on Salt and Health found no difference in chemical content between regular salt and costly gourmet brands. And the reason they did this is because of the claims being made by the purveyors and sellers of these particular compounds. The research analyzed the chemical content of salt, which is sodium chloride, and in this particular thing, they looked at the gourmet brands. And surprise, surprise, they said that they all contain almost 100% sodium chloride and are equally damaging to health in large quantities. Well, again, no surprise with that. And this is Professor Graham McGregor of the Wolfson Institute of Preventive Medicine and chairman of the Consensus Action on Salt and Health in the UK. And he said it was, he said, quote, it was disgraceful that chefs still encouraged people to use so much sea and rock salt. What was interesting is at the end of this, the owners of various companies, one David Lee Wilson, co-owner of the Anglesey Sea Salt Company, which makes Halen Mond Pure White Sea Salt, disputed the research. He told the BBC, quote, this report is not giving a full picture by not going into the other things in either sea salt or the additives in table salt. Well, the only additive in table salt is some iodine to prevent thyroid disease. And Rami Alexander of So Natural, which supplies Himalayan crystal salt. I love the names they come up with. Said, quote, table salt is table salt is a highly refined, processed white substance that's devoid of nutrients. Well, I got to tell you, Mr. Alexander, that that table salt in this case is not that highly refined. They've simply extracted the sodium chloride from what they've mined, just like you're extracting the sodium chloride from the salts that you're mining from various sources. Salt is salt, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't really matter where it's coming from. If it's sodium chloride, it is sodium chloride. Well, we're going to get to the phone lines. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. And good afternoon to Joanne in Ottawa.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I would just like your opinion on something. My sister was told by her doctor she's got extremely bad back pains. Mm-hmm. They're calling it some kind of arthritis.
Okay.
They say it's the cartilage is gone.
Mm-hmm. So she has degenerative disc disease, it's called.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay. So they've got her on heavy, heavy medications.
Mm-hmm.
She's got to take it an hour before she gets up in the morning so she's able to get out of bed.
Right.
They have not done an MRI or a CAT scan, and they're saying there's nothing they can do, but... I
think you sent me an email, right?
Yeah, I did.
I sent you a whole answer earlier.
Oh, I didn't hear anything back yet.
So but I'm going to answer your question anyway. But I sent you an email and also a nice review article on this condition and what can be done. So that's probably in your email box. But okay. The factor is that, as I mentioned, as I remember in the email, she had an X-ray done, but really no other imaging studies
to
determine what her problem is. Ideally, what you want to do is not only just provide medications to try and alleviate someone's pain, you have to have a proper diagnosis. An X-ray will show whether there is damage to bone, whether the space between the vertebrae of the spines is narrowed, which usually indicates that the spongy cartilage or the discs that exist between the vertebrae are breaking down or disappearing. That usually occurs as we get older. Everyone develops this particular condition to varying degrees. For some people, it can be quite painful when the discs start to erode and the vertebrae of the spine start to rub against each other. For others, the pain isn't as bad and their quality of life remains okay. So it's an individualized effect on each person. The point is that if someone is having pain where they can't walk or they're having difficulty walking, you also want to evaluate other factors that can contribute to that. So if, for example, she's getting pain down a specific part of her leg down to her foot, if she's walking stooped over, if there is a risk of osteoporosis, which can also lead to vertebral fractures, all these particular aspects of back pain, as well as muscle pain that results for compensating for it, have to be evaluated. So to give medications, my understanding from the email was that she's been given medications.
It's heavy medication. Yeah, she was starting out with 100 and they said, no, we're going to triple it. So
right.
It's to the point now, like she can't take that for the rest of her life.
Right. And these are narcotic medications.
Yes.
Yeah. There are, when treating pain, I mean, there's varying aspects to treating pain. If we deal with the medication side, narcotics alone are not the solution for chronic pain management because people tend to develop tolerance over time. And you can't keep increasing the dose because it becomes less and less effective as you do that with more and more side effects with it. Secondly, there are other medications that do not have tolerance to them. They don't have the potential for withdrawal symptoms to the same degree that narcotics do. And we have to differentiate between addiction and tolerance. An addiction is when someone stops taking a medication and they do whatever they can to procure the medication. They'll rob, they'll steal, they'll prostitute themselves to generate money to buy the drug because they can't live without it. Tolerance is when you end up with taking a medication and your body gets used to it. And it doesn't alleviate your pain. And when you stop taking medication, you go through withdrawal, but you don't have the urge to go out and get the medication. So there's a difference between the two. So most people will develop tolerance to the medication when used for pain control.
And well, everything nowadays, though, can they not operate or do something like to?
You have to.
Is that something that can be done?
There are a few things that can be done. I just want to return to the medication and then move forward.
Mm-hmm.
There are other medications that are used in combination with narcotics or sometimes without narcotic medications that are also effective at controlling pain. The caveat to that is that some of the medications are covered by provincial insurance plans for people who are over 65 or on benefits or social assistance, and others are not, which complicates the ability to treat and manage the pain. But there are combinations of medications that can be helpful. Now, with regards to degenerative disc disease, if the discs are severely eroded and the spine is reasonably strong, what they may do sometimes is fuse the spine so that the bones don't rub against each other. But again, she has to be evaluated completely before any surgical option is done. So she may need a CT of her spine to make sure that the nerves are not being squished down. We have to look and see if the spine itself or the spinal cord is not being squeezed. So there are many things that need to be evaluated first before she's just told to take the medication and that's all we can do.
And they had told her that there's nothing they can do with what she has. So that's why I was just curious. That doesn't seem right.
But yeah,
she's only 50. So.
Yeah, if she's 50, no. I would say, you know, there has to be more evaluation done.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have her full medical history, but at the same time, if she's so debilitated where she's having this pain, I would say, you know, get a second opinion about what's going on with your back, get the appropriate evaluations done so at least you have a specific diagnosis and potential solutions offered to you.
Okay. Yeah, she goes to the doctors tomorrow, so I just told her to ask to go to a specialist,
okay.
So that would probably be your best bet.
Yeah, and in the email, there's a lot of, the email I sent you, there is a nice, like I said, a review article that you can even send to her. That she can bring to her physician's office because it deals with each of the areas of investigation, how to go about it, and for the various conditions that would lead to back pain.
Well, that sounds good.
All right, Joanne.
Okay,
I hope that was
much.
Helpful. You're very welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Yeah.
We're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we have Mary in Ottawa, who would like to discuss sinus problems. Annabelle in Gatineau also has back pain, which goes down her leg. And Jerry in Orleans would like to discuss blood disorder. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in a few minutes right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Talk 521-8255, star 58 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And a good afternoon to Mary in Ottawa.
Yes.
Hi.
I'll try and be brief.
Well, take your time.
Well, I have MS. I've had it for 30 years. I'm 82.
Mm-hmm.
I weight bear. I tell you this because I think this is something to do with my problem. Years ago, I started collecting phlegm
mm-hmm.
that didn't seem to go down, and I had to get to bring it up.
Okay.
And as I aged and the MS got worse, the problem got worse, and to the point where almost every day, it's rather a disgusting thing I've got, mm-hmm. or at least I think it is. I have to bring up literally a small ginger ale can mm-hmm. of phlegm before I can get my egg and toast down at supper time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes in the daytime, if something goes down the wrong way, unquote, I will start to cough and bring up phlegm.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes on every day for the better part of 2 hours. Namely from 4 to 6.
Okay.
Now, I've had Nasonex.
Mm-hmm.
That was prescribed. That didn't do anything. It just stopped everything from coming down, which eventually it had to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use Salinex now because it loosens the phlegm in my head,
mm-hmm.
and some of it I blow out, the other I cough out.
Right.
My neurologist says it has nothing to do with the MS. I don't believe him. I've seen an ENT, and he says I have an overactive sinus.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is not a problem. The problem is it doesn't go down, and I have to get it up.
Right, and this is every morning when you get up, you have this accumulation.
No, it's every night.
Oh, every night.
Yeah, usually... When I go to bed at 4 in the afternoon, I have my supper mm-hmm. in bed.
Okay.
And so I start and I spray and I blow, and sometimes I will suck on a cough drop
mm-hmm.
and that will loosen the phlegm, but it has to come up because it doesn't go down.
Right, and it's obviously causing you a lot of discomfort because of the accumulation of this.
Well, I'm usually it doesn't bother me in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously collecting.
Correct.
But it's staying there, and I have to get rid of it.
Right.
So where do I go?
Well, the first thing to consider is that I'm just trying to get the timing understood. So you usually go to bed, you said, around 4.
Yes.
And then you said after...
I have a little cranberry juice,
right.
And I have half a banana.
Okay.
And then I start.
Okay, and so it happens when you're lying down or when
I'm sitting up?
No,
I'm sitting up. I have a hospital bed.
Okay.
And so I'm sitting up, not straight up, but quite up.
As I would be in my wheelchair.
Okay, and they have identified the sinus as producing a lot of mucus and such.
Well, the doctor who is now retired called it an overactive sinus.
Okay, did they do any scans of your sinus? Did they
no.
do anything? They didn't. So they haven't really found out where this is coming from.
Well, is it not coming from upstairs?
Okay.
My head? I don't know. I guess it must be.
Well, the issue is that in order to diagnose what's causing this, MS would, you know, MS can sometimes interfere with certain body functions, but at the same time, the mucus has to be produced from somewhere. And that is apart from the MS, because there are cells that produce mucus that gets secreted, and then it can, obviously, it's going down into your throat and accumulating.
Yeah.
So what has to happen is to identify where the source is. That's the first thing, because you can't start giving medications to someone until you actually know where things are coming from. If you don't have a diagnosis, if you haven't done images, they haven't done proper imaging studies, for example, to look at the sinuses.
Wait a minute. Now, I had an MRI. And it would have been of that upper part of me, and nothing showed.
Well, if an MRI was done and was done of
yes, I did have one.
Okay, and they did that of the sinuses or of the neck, or what exactly, what area did they look at?
I don't know.
Because
can I just call my husband and ask him?
Well, really, we have to. I have a limited amount of time. Yeah. So really, for the, you know, again, an MRI would show if the sinuses were chronically congested. It would show that accumulation. So if an MRI didn't show that, then obviously it's got to be coming from somewhere else. Sometimes what can happen is you can get irritation of the esophagus, which can produce a lot of mucus as well. And that usually happens with reflux disease. If you have acid that's coming up, sometimes you don't have to have any heartburn or pain associated with that, but that can also produce mucus production in the esophagus. And when you have to bring it up and before you can even swallow.
But would that affect the fact that my nose is, you know, has to be blown. I blow and I cough up at the same, you know, one time that I blow and the next time I cough up. It's kind of a...
Right. Well, I think what we have to do, though, is we can't just make an assumption that there is one source for this.
I see.
You have to be able to evaluate the entire, you know, you have to evaluate the esophagus, which is the tube that runs from your throat to your stomach.
Yes.
You have to evaluate your respiratory tract to make sure that there's no excessive mucus production that way, and also in the nose itself. So there are different areas. And so part of the puzzle is to determine if one or more of these things is contributing to this. Because if only one treatment is given and you've ignored the other part that could be doing that, you're not going to solve the problem. So ultimately, it's going to mean, given that the person you've seen is retired, is
well, yes, I've been referred to someone else for next May or something. But
right. So if you can, I would see, if you have a family doctor, I would see your family doctor and say, look, can we rule out if this is reflux? Another aspect of this as well is when we use the nasal spray stuff. You mentioned the Nasonex.
Yes.
A lot of times what people tend to do, the technique may not be perfect, because a lot of people will just put the nozzle into the nose and spray it, and they spray it sort of upwards. But really, the nozzle has to go towards the back of the head.
I do that.
Okay, so that's good. But really, what I would say, Mary, is that it sounds like something is not being determined or diagnosed. And so it's not normal for you to be coughing up and bringing up all that stuff every day and not being able to swallow.
Is it not possible that because of the MS, is it not possible that those muscles are weakened and they're not working the stuff down? In other words, it's just sticking there.
Usually, if you can swallow, a good test is if you can drink water or swallow food and it goes down, then the answer is likely it's not affecting that. Because if it was affecting mucus not going down, it would be almost impossible for you to swallow food, which is much denser than the mucus.
Well, but the thing is, unless I get this up before I have my supper,
right?
My supper will literally stick in my throat.
Right, and that's, so what I'm saying, though, is that when that is cleared, you still can swallow. So it is, it's the mucus that's being, that's obstructing your ability to swallow. And that's why I think we have to look at your esophagus to make sure it's not scarred. It's not what we call stenotic, meaning narrowed. And all those things can certainly contribute to the problem you're having. And so that's why I'm saying that it's very important for you not to just focus and have them focus on the nose and the sinuses, but rather look at the whole picture before they just sort of say, use the Nasonex.
Is this something that there could be a solution for?
That's what I'm saying, is that we don't know, but what I'm saying is that if it's got to be something that's doing it, right? You have this accumulation that is stopping you from swallowing, stopping you from eating your food. So there's something there that is impeding that process. And so if it's not coming from the nose, if they've eliminated that, if they said, well, if they look at the MRI and say their sinuses are not congested, there's no postnasal drip, that's not the cause of it, well, then it's got to come from somewhere. If it's not coming from the nose, then you have to look at the esophagus and if something's irritating the esophagus, because when acid splashes up onto the esophagus, it burns it. When it burns it, it can produce mucus. It can get inflamed. It can cause scarring. It can make it more difficult for you to swallow. And so that has to be evaluated as well. And from my understanding from what you've told me is that they have not done that yet. They haven't evaluated that yet.
So I start off with the ENT appointment.
I would have an ENT and perhaps even a gastroenterologist evaluate you too.
Ah, okay. Now, what about he suggested I see a respirologist.
Well, a respirologist would look at the upper respiratory tract, and that also is a very good idea because, again, you're trying to evaluate all those areas that could potentially produce the mucus.
Okay. So a gastroenterologist?
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Mary. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And we're going to take a small break and come back in a couple of minutes. We have Annabelle, who's up next, and then Jerry in Orleans, and then Jim in Ottawa. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we will be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late. Night again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
And we're gonna go straight back to the phone lines and say good afternoon to Annabelle in Gatineau. Annabelle, are you there?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Doctor. I'm in my late 70s, and I have back to the degenerative disc disease. I have osteoporosis, but I'm on Actonel.
Okay.
And lately, in the mornings, I can hardly get up. It's an eroding disc, and I'm waiting for a cortisone shot, supposedly between the L4 and the L5.
Okay.
But in the meantime, I've developed this tingling in my foot, and the pain in down my leg is just excruciating. And I'm on my feet all day, and I'm determined to. I've done exercises. I've tried everything. Is there something in the exercise field, or something that I could do until I get this shot, or is that even going to work?
Well, I think we have to be careful. If you're experiencing pain down the leg, down a specific part of the leg and right down to the foot where it's numb,
Yes. We
have to be concerned about a nerve root that's coming out of the spine at that level that is being pinched.
Okay.
And there are certain things that you would probably not want to do, such as lifting objects, straining your back, because you may actually squish that nerve even more, which would cause even more pain and perhaps even difficulty using the leg. So this may be an unfortunate additional problem with the back, where you may have now the disc either having moved or there's a collapse and the nerve root itself is now being pushed upon, and that's what's giving you the tingling in the foot, especially if it's only on one side and your other leg is okay.
Yes, it is. And I'm just finding that if I raise my right arm to reach something in the cupboard, mm-hmm. it really hurts.
Yeah, so there's something, it sounds like, Annabelle, there's something else now that's happened with the back. And although cortisone will reduce inflammation and perhaps some pressure in that area of the spine, the issue is, though, it's unlikely to reduce the pressure on the nerve, especially if it's a physical compression of that area and not just from inflammation.
Okay.
So they may have to and likely do an imaging of your back to evaluate if the nerve is compressed, to the degree that it's compressed, and what they can offer you with regards to decompressing that nerve.
I see. Well, it's getting progressively worse.
Right.
As you say, if I lift, if I carry groceries or anything, it's almost impossible.
And the issue becomes, again, your ability to take care of yourself, to perform the normal activities of daily life. And if that's becoming increasingly difficult,
yes.
it becomes more imperative to do something to at least see if the damage can be repaired and also offer solutions to mitigate or reduce the effect that it's having on your back so that you don't have to suffer with that pain and subsequent immobility. So I would actually see your doctor again and say, this is new. This is not the same thing. I'm getting the tingling in my foot. The pain radiates down my leg.
Mm-hmm.
That it can possibly be a nerve that's being compressed. And as such, it needs to be evaluated independently of what has been done to date.
And that would be with an imaging.
Usually it's an imaging study that they do.
Okay.
They can certainly evaluate it by physical exam. You know, if you do what we call a straight leg raise, where if you have someone sitting in a chair and you lift the affected leg straight up and out so that the leg is at 90 degrees to the back,
yes.
that usually will pull on the nerve and recreate the pain. Sometimes when you lift the leg up and you take a person's foot and you sort of gently bend the foot up towards them, that's called dorsiflexion, where you lift your foot up. If you're looking at your foot and you move your toes up towards you and you lift the leg up, that tends to pull on the nerve even more and cause more tingling and pain. And that is certainly suggestive of a nerve root that is being pinched. And then usually what you then do is you do an imaging study to see the extent of the damage, whether it's something you would leave alone and hopefully the disc would move away and regress, especially after a sudden injury. You usually leave it for a bit to see if it does do that, or whether it goes on for some time, and that usually what they will do is surgery if after an appropriate amount of time and evaluation it has not helped. And in fact, if the condition worsens, it usually means a referral to a neurosurgeon to provide some evaluation about what they can do.
I see. Well, it is getting progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely will go back to the doctor and see if I can't have him do a scan of my back and see if I can't find out, because it is definitely a nerve that's being pinched. I can tell. It's so painful.
Well, I wish you the best, Annabelle. I hope you feel better soon.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
I really appreciate your opinion, Doctor.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And over to line 4 and Jerry in Orleans. Good afternoon.
Oh, yes, good afternoon.
Hi. Sure.
A couple of months ago, I had a blood clot in my calf.
Okay.
And I think that's called deep vein thrombosis.
That is correct.
Same thing as a phlebitis?
It's a more severe form of phlebitis. Phlebitis simply means a clot in the vein. And a DVT, or deep vein thrombosis, is certainly a clot in the vein, but a much more serious type of clot, because you can get superficial, like veins on the surface of the leg that will get clotted, which you just leave alone. But when you have deep vein thromboses, that's where the clot runs the risk of traveling up the vein and causing further problems.
Well, right now I'll be taking Coumadin, I suspect, for the rest of my life, because I had a phlebitis maybe 35, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question would be, is that considered a blood disorder?
It's not really a blood disorder. There are certainly some clotting disorders that can lead to clots occurring.
Okay.
Usually, and I'm sure you've been to the thrombosis clinic if you had a DVT.
Yes.
They will evaluate whether there was any clotting disorder. And a very common one that's seen, especially in women, is called a factor V laden clotting disorder. And usually it's for women, sometimes if they take a birth control pill or hormone therapy and they have this particular disorder, or they smoke, it can sometimes lead to a clot that occurs. But for many people, there isn't a particular disorder. Sometimes the veins themselves, the valves in the veins themselves, don't work properly, so blood will pool more. And when it pools more, it has a more greater chance of clotting. And once the clot starts, it doesn't stop. It's sort of a cascade reaction that happens. So you ask a very good question, though, because if there was a clotting disorder or a blood disorder, you would have to be also careful about other things that you either eat or do, or medications that you take that could potentially make that worse.
I see.
But they usually will have done those tests, and I'm sure you're going to follow up with them anyway. They usually do this. They usually follow you every so often. And so it's a good question to ask them if any blood tests that they did demonstrated a clotting disorder. But I would imagine they would have told you this, given that this happened several months ago, in order to prevent further clots from occurring.
Well, right now I will be taking, I think in order to pursue why this blood clot was created, I'll be taking a CT scan, an abdominal CT scan.
Right.
In order to probably see if there's anything there that might be hidden and be causing a problem or something like that.
Right. So they've already ordered that for you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So they're being pretty thorough in trying to figure out and actually answer your question about what it is that potentially could have caused this particular clot.
My reason for my call was basically trying to figure out, is this really considered a blood disorder or not? I don't think it is.
No, it's not considered a blood disorder per se.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. And unfortunately, we have only about a minute left. And so, Jim, I can't answer your question about Lyme disease, but if you certainly call next Sunday, I will be more than happy to do so and answer any questions that you have about the condition. My thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. And once again, your calls, always appreciated and always great, frankly, about how you know, people tend to think that, you know, in general, that people don't know very much about medical stuff. But I got to tell you, your questions certainly indicate that on a very consistent basis. I'm very happy to see that, by the way. My thanks to everyone. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.